Switzerland, a couple of weeks ago, called for a meeting of the contracting parties on the Geneva Convention for December 5th, and it took place yesterday, to consider the application of the principles once again to the occupied territories. Notice that's highly relevant today. Notice also that they didn't call for a meeting of the high contracting parties because the U.S. refused to attend. It rejected its clear obligations under international law. All the high contracting parties, including the United States, are obligated to enforce the convention. The meeting took place. It was unreported in the United States. It was reported. I had a friend of mine did me a favor and did a database check of today's papers around the world. It was reported in the English-speaking world with one exception, the usual one. It's pretty difficult to miss the importance of this at the present moment, and it's another quite clear indication of the significance of international law and human rights in the elite intellectual culture. Well, again, easy to give lots of other examples. Let me just give one last one, because I got time, because it's interesting. There's a list of terrorist states. One of the terrorist states is Cuba. Nicaragua almost became a terrorist state. The United States warned a couple of weeks ago that if the population voted for the Sandinistas in the election that just took place, Nicaragua would also be identified as a terrorist state. To be identified as a terrorist state by the United States is no joke. A lot of things follow from that. So the population of Nicaragua understood the point and voted the right way, so we're all praising the election as a free election. Notice that, all of this passes without comment. The United States was condemned by the World Court and the Security Council for terrorism against Nicaragua, but it's determining that Nicaragua is a terrorist state, and nobody notices anything. Same with Cuba. Cuba is a terrorist state. Why? Well, because for 40 years, the United States has been carrying out terrorist acts against Cuba, beginning in October 1959. In fact, Cuba has been the target of more terrorism than probably any other country in the world, maybe all countries combined. So therefore, it's a terrorist state. And these crimes are not small. About a year ago, about 1,000 pages of documentation declassified documents were released from the Kennedy years. That's when the major atrocities started and took place. And a lot of them are about what's called Operation Mongoose, Kennedy's terrorist operations against Cuba, which were quite serious. They were known to be serious. These documents give more information about it. What's particularly interesting about the documents actually was pointed out by Harvard professor Jorge Dominguez in a review of the documents in the main professional journal, Diplomatic History. He pointed out that he's very anti-Cuba, incidentally. I think he's a Cuban exile, in fact, but a good scholar. He pointed out that in 1,000 pages of documents, which describe in some detail pretty serious atrocities, he said he could only find one phrase that raised the question of whether there was anything wrong with carrying out terrorist atrocities in Cuba. That was by a kind of a low-level staff officer who raised the question of whether it might harm U.S. interests if the crimes were exposed, and he was dismissed. The rest of the 1,000 pages don't mention it, and the historical record doesn't mention it. And there's no one bats an eyelash when Cuba's identified as a terrorist state by the state that has been carrying out terrorist actions against it for 40 years, some of them quite serious. One, in fact, came pretty close to leading to a nuclear war. Again, that's just normal practice, and it reflects the prevailing attitudes towards international law and human rights. The scholarly literature, incidentally, is quite the same. If you look at the standard scholarly histories of terrorism by, say, Walter LeCur or Paul Wilkinson and others, if you take a look in the index, you'll find that Cuba's listed. If you look up a lot of listings for Cuba, check them out, and you'll find that each listing is of an allegation that Cuba might have been involved in supporting a terrorist act somewhere, or else it has to do with Cuban support for Angola when it was resisting South African attacks that were murderous and destructive and happened to be backed by the United States and England, so they're not terrorist acts. That's Cuban terrorism. What you won't find is any reference to the uncontroversial record of U.S. terrorism against Cuba. That's not listed. Again, standard scholarly practice. Well, let me say a couple things about human rights. It's not very easy to be all that optimistic about the world and about the directions into which it's heading, but there are encouraging developments, and we shouldn't forget them. One very promising tendency is the slow evolution over the years of a kind of a human rights culture among the general population. That accelerated quite sharply in the 1960s. The popular ferment of those years had a notable civilizing effect on the society in many respects. We see that at MIT. If you look at the composition of the student body today, it's quite different from what it was 40 years ago, as is the character of relations among students and faculty and among students and so on. These things are quite important. One significant feature was a greatly heightened concern for human rights. That includes rights of minorities, of women, rights of future generations. That's the driving force behind the environmental movement, which became quite important in the following years. There's also been considerable progress in formulating universal standards of human rights. Actually, the Universal Declaration of 1948 is the most noteworthy example, but there are others. Unfortunately, it's necessary to stress the word formulating. Implementation is quite a different matter. The way the system works, the Universal Declaration is a statement of principles only. The principles become applicable by means of what are called enabling conventions that are supposed to be established by the General Assembly. And these have to be signed and ratified by states to become applicable to them. Furthermore, even if they are signed and ratified, that has no force unless the conventions are actually applied. And at this point, since there's no enforcement mechanisms, we turn to the responsibilities of citizens. They have the responsibility of ensuring that the fine words do not remain what James Madison once called a mere parchment barrier in the way of tyranny and oppression. So they have to compensate for the lack of external enforcement mechanisms, which is the only way to give any substance to these pronouncements. Well, the extent to which this responsibility is undertaken is another measure of the commitment to international law and human rights. I'm not going to pursue that. I'll leave that as an exercise. It's a useful one for those who want to learn something about ourselves. Stress again that a profound flaw in the international system and an indication of the fragility of the commitment to human rights is the fact that the enabling conventions are toothless. Even when they're ratified, human rights are, as I mentioned, assigned a far lower value than the rights of investors and lenders. So corporations are granted extraordinary rights in current international investor rights agreements, far beyond ordinary persons. They had already been granted the rights of persons a century ago through radical judicial activism, and these rights were then conferred not on the corporation, but on the corporate management that created a new absolutism, in the words of the leading legal historian of the process of transformation of American law, to transfer effective power to private tyrannies that are scarcely accountable to the public. That's Morton Horowitz of Harvard Law School. In the new international economic order today, these rights are extended far beyond those of persons. So General Motors, for example, can claim what's called national treatment in Mexico, but if a Mexican person of flesh and blood were to demand national treatment in Texas after crossing the border, assuming he made it alive, he wouldn't make out very well. The private tyrannies can also bring suit against governments to undermine regulations that were established to protect health or safety or the environment. And they can do that on the ground that the regulations may restrict their future profits. They are, technical terms, tantamount to expropriation under fanciful new legal doctrines of regulatory taking that have been created by ultra-right radical judicial activism. These aren't abstract possibilities. They've already been implemented, and the corporations win in the panels of trade representatives that operate in secret without rules of evidence or other judicial constraints. Persons of flesh and blood have no comparable rights. So it's not correct anymore to say that corporations have the rights of immortal persons. It's way beyond that in current legal doctrine.